Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Great to be with you here today. And I think I wanted to start by saying how delighted I was to see the topic, the theme for this conference. In fact, it was about 6 years ago, just a little bit more than 6 years ago, at a previous international student recruitment conference where our work began. And of course, the focus in the early days was so much around getting the numbers in. And it is so encouraging to see the international theme today being about improving the international experience and how through that we attract and retain international students in an increasingly competitive market. So I've been set the challenge of asking, how does the UK compare? I thought it might help to provide a little bit of context about our work, and in particular the opportunity to say thank you to so many of you in the audience, not just for being the inspiration for the work that iGraduate has been engaged in for the past 6 years, but for many of you, the foundation of our work as well. It was British universities who convinced me that we really did need to understand in particular what international students expected, wanted and thought of their time in the UK. And that work has grown since then, now to having been adopted by over 1,200 institutions around the world, and an astonishing degree of feedback, in fact, and just in the weeks before Christmas, over 250,000 students telling us what they thought of their experience, but also their decision-making expectations and future intentions as well. There's been a lot of talk this morning, not just about the student experience, but repeated reference to employment, employability and graduate outcomes. And I do think that that is the paired challenge now. The UK has been particularly good at leading the way in addressing student expectations in terms of the student experience itself. But I firmly believe that as we all look to the years ahead, our institutions will be judged increasingly on the outcomes in terms of career destinations. And I hasten to say, not 6 months after graduation, but the career trajectories and the opportunities that we create for the students who study at our institutions. Our work has extended, in fact, from international students now to include that one missing nationality, the home country students in each of the countries where we're working. And I'm delighted to say now that the UK's five largest universities each year are using this process to track not just what international students think, but to treat all students in one sense as international, putting that in the context of the increasingly sophisticated demands of our home students as well here. And there's a list there of some of the other countries that we're working in around the world. And yes, we've been delighted to be home to the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education since 2010, and their work continues with the resources that we've been able to provide. And in fact, I'll make more reference to that later on. But let's take a broader context. The challenge, as I said, that I was set, how does the UK compare? Politicians love to describe how education is world-class, whether it's our politicians in the UK or in any other country in the world. And I think we have a genuine and sincere challenge to either reassure ourselves that that is the case based on substantive data, or to question whether we should be quite so complacent. So there evidently is a need to track opinion and to use the reporting of it to enhance provision. An important point to make, although other points are displaying themselves now, is that where the UK led the way in 2005, 6, 7 and 8, and Paul was reporting, and thank you for that, Paul, the terrific evidence of enhancement of the international student experience across the last 5 years. But what is important, I think, my third point there, that much of the world of education now gets it and is there already. And in particular, the references that Paul made to Germany and Japan. And Germany began to follow the work that was being done in the UK to mirror the processes of tracking international student expectations and perceptions in 2009, and is now in the third year of doing that, but with very considerable central government resource, whereas in the UK and in many other countries, this work is driven by individual institutions effectively subscribing, joining into the process. But significant central government commitment in Germany. And what was amazing to see, the German universities don't mind me saying, that there wasn't a huge culture of student support, of international student support in German universities. And the almost missionary zeal with which the feedback from international students was received for institutions to say, now we know what we can do, now we know what we need to change, and as we know, the resources in Germany to be able to make those changes. And there's one other parallel I'd like to draw, which is not just in terms of nations versus nations, but the brief references that we made to public versus private sector and the increasing significance of the private sector. I think what I found most challenging is the speed with which the private sector can respond while in a public sector institution, inevitably there was a need for debate around feedback, findings, rankings, ratings, anything. Universities, as many of you have heard me say before, are built on argument. That's why they exist, or that's how they work. And yet with the private sector, the ability for institutions, for individuals to say, so we are going to change this, we're going to put this money here, we're going to change that program there and make sure these students are served, is, I think, a particular challenge between the public and private sector, because the pace of change now has to measure up to those that are responding fastest, I think, as time moves on. So what is important is that what we've seen here is a sector-driven model for opinion surveys, not government-imposed, but inspired by and shaped by the sector. With that popular phrase, putting students at the heart of the system. But of course, I think vitally recognising that students should be at the heart of the system, but they're one part of the system, and so we need to objectively determine the opinions of all stakeholders in the academic enterprise. We do need to understand, to have metrics for understanding opinion in a way that there hadn't been a historical culture of doing so. Because through this we enable better informed decision making, and as a result of this, evidently what we're able to do is to assist the enhancement of provision and the advancement of education. I gave us some more thought ahead of this conference particularly, and there are a few themes that reflections and themes that I thought might be helpful in the minutes that we have, and then I promise I will come on to some real numbers as well, which I know is what you really want me to do. In my view, I think the obsessive growth of rankings might suggest that the education sector loves to compare itself. But in fact, it reflects frustrations with the harsh reality that while each education experience is unique, the convergence of education systems, of pedagogies, and of delivery methods across the world makes substantive external differentiation harder than ever. But this convergence of higher education, coinciding with the death of distance, as we call it, the fact that the brightest and wealthiest can study more or less anywhere in the world, and the immediacy of global communications we're hearing reference to earlier on, meaning that reputations are being defined and redefined almost daily, has created a cauldron of competition. At the far end of the spectrum, there is a new war for talent raging quietly across the playing fields of every Ivy League institution and every other research-led institution in the world. And for the rest of the sector, across almost every major nation, the numbers game intensifies. So for good or bad, well, everybody sees education as a good thing, and more education should, in the wider scheme of things, be good, provided, of course, that quality is sustained and enhanced. And it's great to see the QAA's logo up on this board here. I think the good news comes from Darwin, ably assisted by what I call the collapse of time. That, again, as was referenced earlier on, for centuries, reputations have endured for centuries. But today, substandard provision in a suburb of Sydney will flash around the world in a week. And only the sorry student that hasn't heard of Google won't know, or won't be able to know. So few people today will maintain a degree of blissful ignorance when choosing their degree. And that means that the student experience is now hardwired to all recruitment, whether we like it or not. So almost all educators, whether engaged primarily in the business of education or of self-preservation, are increasingly steeled by immeasurable indicators of real-time reputation, student satisfaction, and, as I've suggested, graduate outcomes too. I think in universities around the world, the vast majority of educators want to deliver a great education and, to varying degrees, extend the outer reaches of knowledge. So there is a compelling logic to having an external, independent, and objective means of determining the opinions held by their people. If those people, in terms of stakeholders, are assured of confidentiality, they will respond with levels of honesty and frankness that have, frankly, recently been reserved for candid communications outside the university, in communicating with the world outside and instead providing a medium for feedback within the institution. And comparing what people say across the sector, institutions will know when and where they fall behind rivals. So at the international level, governments will know what aspects of national provision either are or aren't world-class. Within universities, departments will understand where to raise their game and where we should praise our colleagues. Ultimately, this should lead to the enhancement of provision, as I've said, of the education to the individual and, in turn, to the advancement of education worldwide. And some of this rationale, obviously, we've visited before. But where does the bigger picture take us? In my view, it takes us as educators to an enduring and intensifying accountability to all students and to all stakeholders in the academic enterprise. And so as the battle for brains intensifies, the bigger picture is of a bigger challenge than we've ever known before. What does that mean in practical terms? Well, there was a reference, in fact, in the discussion prior to the break to the importance of agents and whether agents are a good or a bad thing and how the extent of their influence. Each year for the past 5 years now, we've been tracking what education agents think and say about destination countries. And what I found interesting about that is that the speed with which agents pick up the vibes that are out on the airwaves is amazing. The talk earlier on about the difficulties that Australia had experienced with student safety and visa factors, and the speed with which opinions were reversed with the implementation of the Knight recommendations. I think it's almost unprecedented that a report to government with something like 47 recommendations, all of them were implemented within 24 hours, all of them were accepted within 24 hours. And the message that sent back out to the markets has had a substantial effect. Well, let's have a look at the effect that it's had. Starting with the USA, this is on the basis of what typically 800 to 1,000 education agents are saying about the attractiveness of destination countries. In 2011, 72% of agents said the US is a very attractive place to study. An important point to recognise about the US, it has been picked up elsewhere before, that there's a raging debate around whether agents should be permitted at all, whether universities should be permitted to pay agents for their services. The vast majority of agents who are saying the US is a great destination are still not being paid by universities in America to say that, and nor to recruit students for it. So it's interesting to note how attractive the US is, despite that fact. For the UK, you can see there was a high point in 2009, and in fact, in terms of the percentage of agents saying the UK is very attractive, it's dropped from 72% down to 63% across the past 3 years, no doubt reflecting some of the current challenges that we have. One of the points that wasn't picked up so much in the earlier session, I think, was the significance of Canada effectively getting its act together nationally, and the extent to which we're seeing very strong positioning, coordinated positioning of Canada as a destination, or more coordinated than before. And certainly in terms of employment and employability strategies and policies, that having a very strong impact compared to the other traditional rival nations. And Australia, what's interesting to see here, this data was collected in November, so just before Christmas time, and I was just making a reference to the Knight report, the Knight review, that we've seen a leap from 40% of agents saying that Australia was a very attractive destination up to 47%. We think largely influenced by that. And the other country, of course, we should certainly never forget, where we're very actively engaged at the moment across all the sectors of education. New Zealand, with what we've seen is, for the last 3 years, a steadily increasing degrees of attractiveness. Of course, New Zealand as a country has its own challenges, but in terms of the education that students are getting and the outcomes and the opportunities that are provided, we're seeing strong positive enhancement. Of course, that's just one perspective. That's just what education agents say. And given the limitations of time, I'd cut out of my presentation what prospective students say and what others say. But I will come now on to what current students are saying about the UK experience. In fact, I haven't used the most current data, but I'm hoping you're able to pick out some of those numbers. Effectively, looking against the global ISB index, the global barometer of student experience, you can see against most measures we're either on a par with or ahead of other countries, and in terms of learning overall, marginally ahead. From the survey point that we're referencing here, 86% again is the global index, 87% the UK, so we can confidently say the UK experience is world-class looking at those measures there. And in fact, I think I've picked out here careers advice and employability, in fact, where the UK clearly leads the world. However, I'll come back to that in a moment in terms of whether I think that's sufficient to have 72% on that particular survey point satisfied. But I think the other thing I want to emphasise is that when we're looking at whether we're world-class and we look against a global indicator like that, it gives the politicians the numbers that they want and the reassurance that we are. But of course what you have to do is compare country by country, and we've specifically avoided naming countries just as we avoid naming institutions. It's about what countries can do to enhance their provision, just as it is for universities. But you can see here that across a comparator set of countries, of host countries, that there is one that appears to outperform the UK in several areas, some infrastructure and some in terms of, as you can see, performance feedback as well. One of the issues that's repeatedly picked up from the NSS. So it is important to see who we're comparing against and the extent. While we can publicly be confident that we're world-class, we should never be complacent with that. But the other reference that was made this morning was to the tracking of the international student experience and change over time. And it is evident that we've seen an increase overall on average by 8 percentage points to 80% across the period that the barometer process has been running in British universities. And I've picked out there some of the highest, some of the most significant increases in satisfaction that we've seen. Now, I have to stress that there is still absolutely no evidence that expectations are getting any lower. It is about British universities in particular being extremely responsive to student expectations and to student perceptions. It's not necessarily also about huge infrastructure expenditure, although in some specific cases it is, but it's particularly about the engagement of colleagues across institutions, recognising the complexity, the diversity of expectation that exists, and doing what can be done to address students' concerns. So visa advice is an excellent example. I think we're taking this up to 2010 rather than 2011, but we're seeing, in fact, we're about to start reporting, even in the past year, across the past year, the most difficult year of all, we have more international students satisfied with the visa support provided by their university. Now, we are, of course, also tracking what students think of the visa experience in terms of processing their visa and the local office in their home country and how satisfied they were with that. But at least at the university level, we're seeing evidence, again, in a very challenging times, of institutions doing a great job in supporting and helping students through those visa processes. And in employability too, that's a very significant increase. But let's look at some of the more specifics, just so that you have the completed picture from the outline that was given earlier on today. So in the learning experience, we see that very strong improvement across all of those indicators. In the living experience, there was one in particular that I wanted to pick out, given the panel that we, the people that we have on the podium at this point in the morning, recognition of the students' unions and the work that's been done by Christina, by Aaron in his time as NUS president, and by students' unions and student activities across the UK, to see a very significant increase in student satisfaction there. Some great work being done on integration. And, of course, at this time we should highlight that Dominic's here somewhere, the work that's been done by UKISA in enhancing provision too. But other areas of very significant increase, worship facilities, something that may have seemed peripheral in days gone by, and certainly what you'll still see in these surveys is that there's a relatively small proportion of students for whom faith provision is important, but of course faith provision is very important to those students, and so it's vital that we address their needs, and great to see those improvements over time, and in many other aspects as well. Now, one point I was going to pick up in terms of what are the most recent things that we've seen just in the last 2 or 3 months among students in terms of their decision-making. Very significant increases in concerns around the importance of personal safety, and referencing what was said earlier on today around the cost of study, something that we need to keep a track of. But at least this is what students are saying who are actually engaged in that student experience in terms of how safe they're feeling, for example, and their perceptions here around living cost. Careers, I mentioned that I would come back to this. So the UK, as I've said, can say that it's world-class and ahead of rivals. But I do think this is the one area which is unsustainable as it stands. There isn't yet a career service in the UK that is adequately resourced to meet the expectations of all of its students. And by the way, we've seen higher ratings from international students in some cases than for domestic students, as domestic student expectations are rocketing in terms of career outcomes. And so when we come to Gretchen Dobson's session this afternoon, it's very important to look at how you hardwire that connection between student experience and alumni at the university, effectively the university at large, and how we harness the network that we have in our alumni to connect students. Not as basic as getting students jobs with alumni, but how they can help in terms of helping understanding of the employment context, the careers context, the marketplaces around the world. And in support services, here picking up that point about the very significant improvement in terms of visa advice, the sterling work that's still being done by the international offices, who were highly rated right from the beginning, but whose work inspired the wider work that's being done here, and counselling and student advisory services too. So, noting that my time is almost up, I said that I would also come back to reference the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education and their long-awaited international branch campus report, which was the previous version. The previous version of this was 2009, reported just last week, and Joanna was referring to the massive expansion of transnational education, and the observatory has identified, or the research team there have identified, 200 international branch campuses, which is significantly up on the last time the report was produced. You might have seen some of this in the press. But I think importantly, noticing 37 more to open in the next 2 years. This typically we're seeing this is still led by the US, but very significantly increasing activity from UK universities internationally. Again, going back to what Joanna was saying earlier on. Some of the other numbers are there too. But we've also seen much more movement in terms of branch campuses between countries in Asia in particular. That's the kind of traditional, as reference was made earlier, to the work we're doing with Nottingham Ningbo or Nottingham in Malaysia or Liverpool, wherever they are. But I think, aside from branch campuses, recognising and going back to that point that Joanna made, that there's in total over 400,000 students studying for a British degree or in British higher education offshore. And we have to ask what students think of that, how the experience compares, and whether we are confident in terms of teaching quality and in terms of the possible reputation risk. Now, of course, the QEA has a major part to play there, but I personally believe it's really about what we as institutions do to reassure ourselves, whether the experience should be directly comparable or whether we're simply looking to make sure that our students are comparatively delighted around the world. I think it's vital that we now start to see the entire student community to include that community at large outside the UK and not just those that are on our traditional campuses. Now, I recognise that the way that this is projected, probably you won't see as much as I want you to. But the way in which we've addressed that is, having spent 5 or 6 years, many of you watching hundreds of pages of PowerPoint presentations, we've now reached the point of interactive reporting where institutions now can see by faculty, by department, by course, in some cases, how their students' perceptions compare. But what, for those of you who can see the table fully, on the left you'll see that by study type you can pick out and compare the perceptions, so long as you're surveying them in the first place, of your distance learners, your full-time students, your part-time students, often very different expectations and very different perceptions, those engaged in student exchange and so on. And that work has been led by the University of Oxford but is increasingly being rolled out now across other institutions. And I think I'll come back to the most important point there, which is the ability for colleagues to work with this type of feedback rather than it descending from a great height into somebody's office. Also, the importance of being able to aggregate. In this example, looking at the previous academic cycle, 2010-11, where we were able to take 54,000 international students in the UK, combine their views to understand their perceptions, in this case, comparative perceptions of support overall. But this is where we're also, this is the way in which we're interactively reporting use of agents, perceptions of agents, perceptions of the visa process. And I think, what was the other one we had here? The service of visa office staff in their country. In this case, remember, we're looking back at 2010, but green means students in that country rated higher and red means lower. Interesting, in this case, last year, Indian students were comparatively satisfied with the service they received from visa office staff. I think the challenge there particularly was the time taken to process visas. But at least taking an aggregate picture is helpful to be able to see how the UK stacks up. And I'm not sure how well this is displaying, but what I want us to look at here is how we close the loop. That traditionally we would invite student feedback, collect feedback, aggregate and compare and report back to institutions. But what needs to happen beyond that, of course, is the institution-level disaggregation, the dissemination within the institution, interpretation, prioritisation, resource allocation, implementation of changes, and then doing the whole thing again. In that way, enabling us to understand what it is that students really think and how we're changing and how those changes are being perceived. I think I'm going to move on to I will move on to conclude now. In summary, the most important thing, I think, is that we do embed insight processes within our institution, that it's not simply something that we duck in and out of, but that it's part of how an institution makes decisions. I think in order to resolve some of those perennial arguments, it's essential that we do continue to compare and track the experience, that we measure ourselves not just against our traditional rivals, but against rivals internationally around the world, and that we track the changes at our own institution. And my final point, which I was referencing with those interactive charts, the importance of empowering colleagues to enable change, giving people the data to work with to enable them to see what needs where their attention needs to be focused most. But finally, most of all, to get on with it, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.